Hello, and welcome back to our very special and important study of Daniel chapter 9, 24 and following, and the question, when was or when will the 70 weeks of Daniel chapter 9, 24 and following come to an end? This question is so important because, as I've shared with you, Daniel chapter 9, verse 24, the constituent elements that were to be fulfilled within the 70 weeks all point us directly to the resurrection, the coming of salvation, the messianic temple, the messianic ruler. Again, salvation, redemption, forgiveness, atonement, all of those things. Therefore, if it is true, as I am setting forth in this series, if it is true that the 70 weeks of Daniel chapter 9, 24 and following were to be fulfilled by the time of the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, that means the coming of the Lord, the judgment, the resurrection, the kingdom, all arrived by that time. Now, that may be shocking. Believe you me, it was when I began contemplating it. But the point of fact is, Daniel chapter 9 sets forth such a delimited context framework and time frame for its fulfillment that it's literally undeniable when we properly consider it. We are given the beginning point of the countdown. We are given another checkpoint during the countdown, and we are given the full end of the countdown. It has always been baffling to me how commentators can go there and they can set the end point of the 70 weeks completely outside the framework of the 70 weeks. And we'll have a video on that as we proceed. I've already addressed it, the view that the 70 weeks ended in 34-35 AD. Today's video will likewise address that claim. And this is video number two on the subject of the question, because the question of Daniel chapter 9 says 70 weeks are determined to finish the transgression. I shared with you in the last video how the ancient rabbis, the Hebrew scholars, are virtually, I won't say they're unanimous, but there is a tremendously wide range of consensus among the Hebrew scholars and the commentators that to finish the transgression meant to fill up the measure of sin. I showed you from the Old Testament that the concept of the filling up of the measure of sin, number one, belongs in a context of the discussion of God's dealings with Israel. Not, listen to me very carefully and please catch the power of this. It is not set within the context of the nations filling up the measure of their sin. Now, let's be sure. It would be possible, it certainly was true in the time of Abraham, that non-Israelite nations could fill up the measure of their sin. I believe that has to do with God raising up kingdoms and destroying them. But in Genesis chapter 15, God promised Abraham the land of Canaan. And he said, it will be in four generations, however, because the sin of the Amorites is not yet full. So there is a principle there that must be acknowledged. However, Daniel 9 is not focused on the nations filling up the measure of their sin, because the text says 70 weeks are determined on your people, Daniel, and on the holy city. That's Israel, that's Jerusalem. It's not America, it's not Russia, it's not China, it's not South America. This prophecy is focused on Israel. And so when we ask the question in regard to the filling up of the measure of sin, we must realize and we must focus on the time in which Israel would fill up the measure of their sin in their consummated form. Now, let me remind you that the motif of filling up the measure of sin and the promise of the vindication of the martyrs runs from Genesis 4, 10, and 11 all the way through to the book of Revelation and all the way to maps. It is a constant theme. I offer, by the way, in my bookstore, a book by Sam Dawson. Sam's a good friend of mine. He wrote a massive book, big book, on the avenging of the blood of the martyrs. You really, really ought to purchase a copy of that book. Just go to my bookstore, donkpreston.com, bibleprophecy.com, and look up Dawson Revelation or Dawson Avenging the Blood, what have you. I've even forgotten the precise name of the book at this point. But Dawson does an extensive, comprehensive discussion of the motif of the filling up of the measure of sin and how it related to Israel in Israel's last days. And let me begin today's video by pointing out that in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 43, in what we know as the Song of Moses, pardon me, and listen, folks, I've got to tell you, the Song of Moses is one of the most magnificent, incredible, powerful, and important prophecies in all the Bible. Over the years, I have increasingly fallen in love with a study of Deuteronomy chapter 32. And here's the reason why. Many scholars have taken note of the fact that Jesus in his ministry cites, quotes, alludes to, and echoes Deuteronomy 32 over and over again. Some scholars say that the Song of Moses is, quote, paradigmatic. It forms the entire paradigm. It serves as a source for Jesus' ministry. In addition, scholars such as J. Ross Wagner in his book, Heralds of the Good News, men such as Richard Hayes, in their commentaries, point out how Paul, especially, in the book of Romans, appeals to, quotes from, the Song of Moses for his eschatology. Oh, and he applies it to his generation. So, here is the Song of Moses, and let's be perfectly clear that in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 5 and following, Moses is told that after many, many generations to come, the children would ask their fathers, what does this mean? And their fathers were supposed to tell them that it referred to the time of Israel's last days. Pardon me. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, 19 and following, the Lord says that in Israel's last days, they would turn their back on the Lord, and He would turn His back on them. And He laments, oh, that they were wise. Oh, that they were not so foolish. Oh, that they would consider what their latter end will be. Deuteronomy 32, 29 to 31. Once again, He says, oh, that they were wise. Oh, that they would consider what their last end will be. So here is a prophecy. It was very clearly not for Moses' day. It would be for the last days. Matter of fact, as the prelude and as the lead-in to the song, Yahweh, through Moses, said, and Moses told Israel, I know that after my departure, I know that after my death, you in the last days, notice that, in the last days. Eschaton ton hemeron is the Greek, that is the Septuagint. In the last days, you will grow utterly corrupt. What does that mean? Oh, it means you're going to fill up the measure of your sin. Now, let's digress here for just a moment, although it's not a digression. Moses says that in Israel's last days, she would fill up the measure of her sin. And here's something we have to consider. In the amillennial and in the postmillennial world, it is extremely common to argue that God was through with Israel at the cross. Israel, after the cross, was no longer God's covenant people. We are told that God's covenant with Israel, i.e. the law of Moses, the Mosaic covenant, was nailed to the cross. Well, okay, if God was through with Israel, if God was through with the law of Moses, which means he would have been through with Deuteronomy 32, if God was through with Israel and the old law, including Deuteronomy 32, at the cross, then that means that Israel's last days had to have existed prior to the cross, and it means that Israel had to have filled up the measure of her sin prior to the cross. Oh, wait a minute. And that means, you got to catch the power of this. That means that when God said in Deuteronomy 32, verse 43, "Rejoice, O nations, with my people." Well, I won't discuss that except to say this. When God would act as he is about to promise, it would be the time in which the Gentiles could come fully into the blessings of Israel's salvation. The nations would rejoice with Israel. Oh, but wait. What does it say? "Rejoice, O nations, with my people, for God has avenged the blood of his saints." Okay, go back to what I just said. Do you see the train coming? If God was through with Israel at the cross, if God nailed the law of Moses, including the song of Moses, to the cross, then that means that Israel's last days were prior to the cross and fulfilled at the cross. It means that Israel filled up the measure of her sins and became utterly corrupt prior to the cross. And it means that God avenged the blood of his saints prior to the cross. Oh, but wait. Oh, but wait. In Matthew chapter 23, we have Jesus standing in the temple saying to the Jews, "You are those who bear witness against yourselves that you are the sons of those who killed the prophets. Because you say, well, if we would have lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have slain the prophets, and thereby you bear witness to yourselves that you are indeed the sons of those who killed the prophets." Now watch this. "Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt." Now wait a minute. What did Deuteronomy 31 say? "I know that after my departure in the last days, you will become utterly corrupt." Jesus, who, by the way, came in the last days, and who the Hebrews writer says he was living, that is, the writer of Hebrews was living in the last days. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. "God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake in time past by the fathers, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son." So Jesus appeared in the last days. The writer of Hebrews, after the cross, was living in the last days. It was in the last days that Israel was to fill up the measure of their sin. And Jesus, in Matthew 23, speaking to the Jews, while he was standing in the temple, said, fill up the measure of your father's guilt. How were they going to fill up the measure of their father's guilt? Oh, behold, I send to you apostles and prophets and wise men. Some of them you shall crucify and scourge and chase from city to city, that upon you, now watch this, may come all of the righteous blood, of all of the righteous, from righteous Abel unto Zacharias, whom you slew between the temple and the altar. Does that include their father's guilt? And remember, he said, fill up the measure of your father's guilt. Your sins and the sins of your fathers, Isaiah 65, verse 6 and following, will I measure into your bosom. And that's in a context of the prediction of the last days that Paul applied to his generation in Romans 10, 20 and 21. So, here we have the position of the amillennialist and the postmillennialist that says God was through with Israel at the cross. God was through with the law of Moses, including Deuteronomy 32, at the cross. And yet here's Deuteronomy 31 and 32, speaking of Israel filling up the measure of their sin in the last days and predicting the avenging of the blood of the saints. And here is Jesus in Matthew chapter 23 saying that the Jews would fill up the measure of their sin and their father's sin, not at the cross, but by persecuting and killing his own apostles and prophets, which took place not prior to the cross, not at the cross, but in the persecution of Jesus' apostles and prophets after the cross. And this is precisely what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 14 to 16, where the apostle says, you, brethren, became the followers of those and the imitators of your brethren in Judea who have suffered the like things as you have at the hands of your countrymen, you know, the Jewish countrymen who were now persecuting them, who both killed the Lord and the prophets, and they do persecute us, and they, that's the apostles, and they forbid us to speak to the Gentiles that they might be saved. Here is a reiteration of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 23. It was taking place after the cross, and listen to Paul's words. They had killed the prophets. They've killed Jesus. They are persecuting us, the contrary to all men, and they are filling up the measure of their sin always. That was written in 50 AD. Okay, now watch. So, here's Deuteronomy chapter 32. Talking about Israel becoming utterly corrupt, filling up the measure of their sin in the last days. Here is Deuteronomy chapter 32 that posits that filling up the measure of Israel's sin in the last days at the time of Israel's last end. And in that last end of Israel, in the last days, God would avenge the blood of His saints. Now, if God was through with Israel and the law of Moses at the cross. Now follow me here. Follow me here. If Daniel 9, not if, but since Daniel 9 says that the filling up of Israel's sin was limited to the 70 weeks, okay, then if the filling up of the measure of sin took place, number one, at the cross, or number two, by AD 34 or 35, then that means that Israel's sin had to be fulfilled by the time of AD 34 or 35, or, as we have seen, at the cross. But wait a minute. Remember, Paul, writing in 50 AD, said Israel was filling up the measure of their sin when he wrote. How were they filling up the measure of their sin? Oh, by killing the apostles and prophets, which Jesus said in Matthew 23 is what would fill up the measure of their father's guilt. Once again, since the filling up of the measure of Israel's sin, i.e. finishing the transgression of Daniel 9:24, is limited to and is would be confined to the 70 weeks of Daniel, and since Jesus and since Paul, oh, and by the way, since John in Revelation says that Babylon, i.e. the city where the Lord was crucified, since her cup was now full, how? Because she was killing the apostles and prophets and the saints of the Lord. Her cup is now full, Revelation 17, verse 6. Because of her killing of the apostles and prophets. Well, the killing of the apostles and prophets took place long after 34-35 AD. Therefore, the filling of the measure of sin of Daniel 9, finishing the transgression, took place after 34-35 AD. That means the 70 weeks did not end in 34 or 35 AD. Now, I've just got to share this with you because this is so, to me, incredibly powerful. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, and I have to tell you this, this passage has been really, really troublesome to scholars down through the years. As a result of this passage, and other passages, by the way, such as 2 Corinthians chapter 3, scholars such as Johann Munk, a German scholar early in the 20th century, Johann Munk said, you know, Paul was either an egomaniac Or he saw himself as the critical, eschatological figure to bring in the coming of the Lord. I'm pretty convinced Paul was not an egomaniac. Now, in my book, Elijah Has Come, A Solution, Romans 11, 25 to 27, I make the comment over and over. John the Baptizer is the most significant eschatological figure in the New Testament other than Jesus and Paul. And I'm going to vindicate the significance of Paul in the eschatological narrative. And here's part of how we'll do that. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 9, and again, this is one of the passages that scholars have said, wow, how could Paul say this? Because after all, they imposed then their personal eschatological paradigm on the text, saying, well, clearly, Paul was wrong because the end didn't come soon. So Paul must have been an egomaniac after all. So what am I talking about? 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 9. I think that God has displayed us, the apostles, last as men condemned to death. For we've been made a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to men. Wait a minute. Paul, what did you say? I think God has displayed us, the apostles, last as men condemned to die. We have been made a spectacle. Here's what you have to know about this text. And listen, men, commentators go to great length to avoid the force of this text. But when Paul says, we've been made a spectacle, that is from the Greek word theatron. And when Paul says, God has set forth us, the apostles, lest as men condemned to die. I mean, virtually all commentators these days who take knowledge of, who take note of the Greek, call attention to this. Paul is drawing on the Roman world and the staging of what they called a triumph. If a general went off to war and he was victorious and he whipped the enemies of Rome and he conquered kings and princes and politicians and what have you, took them captive, along with the gold and the silver and all the other goodies, they would come back to Rome and they would have this huge parade. And they would set forth as theatron, because that's what it was. It was a huge drama. They would set forth, you know, they'd just bring hundreds and hundreds, sometimes thousands of slaves, the lowest of the low. The off-scouring of society, of the society that they had just conquered. And they would march them along in ascending order of importance. They would bring in, the wealthy. Then they would bring along maybe politicians, senators, maybe philosophers, prominent philosophers from the country that they had conquered. And then, last of all, at the end of the parade, here comes the king that they have conquered and captured. Now, as this parade goes along, sometimes, and it all depended upon what they decided to do that day, but they would take maybe one of 10, one of 20, whatever. It varied. But in this progression of slaves, for instance, they would take one of 10. They would take them up to the Palatine Hill, and there's a great big bluff there, drop off. Great big, huge, long drop off. And that 10th individual, whom they had chosen at random, would be thrown off the cliff to die. And that's the way it proceeded. Slaves, ascending order, ascending order, ascending order. One out of 10, thrown off the Palatine Bluff. And then here comes the king, the most important one, the royal dignitaries. And guess what happened to him? Yep. Off the Palatine Hill. Or sometimes they cut their head off, or sometimes they burnt them at the stake, or, you know, whatever. Just depending on whatever they wanted to do that particular time. If that king had been a particular thorn in the flesh of Rome, then he was reserved for some particularly heinous death. But what's the point? The point of it was that the most important are the last to die. Now, some commentators say, well, no, that's not what Paul's saying. Paul is writing to the Corinthians who believe that the apostles are low, they are abased, but they, the Corinthians, but they're exalted. Now, there's no question that Paul is absolutely using irony in this context. And he said, you're kings, but we're not. Well, here's the problem. In those contrasts, Paul is talking about, here's how you look at the apostles. You look at us as servants. You look at us as debased. But here's the reality. God has set forth us, the apostles, last. Now, no Roman, no Jew, living in the first century, aware of, knowledgeable of the theatron of the Roman triumphs, would ever, ever, ever imagine that when Paul said, now notice the contrast here. Paul talks about, here's what you, the Corinthians, think of us, the apostles, but, here's what God has done. You see, Paul is contrasting the way God thinks and the way God has acted versus the Corinthians. He's not saying, well, you know, yeah, God set forth us. We're just scum of the earth and we're just nothing. No. God has set forth us, the apostles, last of all. They're the last in the triumph. And by the way, let's not forget Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 14 and following. Paul uses the same identical imagery. God leads us forth in triumph. We are His triumphant theatron. But let me reemphasize this because this is so incredibly important. When Paul said that it was God who set the apostles last in the line, he is talking about their exalted and important position. Now, scholars, liberal scholars, say, but this is ridiculous. How could Paul possibly say that the apostles had been set forth as the last men to die? Millions upon millions of Christians have died since. That is not the point. Paul is linking himself and the apostles, as we shall see momentarily, to the filling up of the measure of sin. Now remember, Matthew 23, Luke 13, 28 and following, Luke 11, 49 and following, Jesus posited the apostles and their partners, so to speak, as the pivotal players in filling up the measure of suffering by being the ones whom Israel would persecute to fill up the measure of their sin. So Jesus was, in fact, setting forth the apostles and the prophets as those last to die in order to fill up the measure of sin so that Israel would fill her transgression. Fulfilling Daniel 9:24. But again, folks, and this is where it's so critical. The killing of the apostles and prophets took place well after 34 and 35 AD. Thus, Daniel 9:24, 70 weeks are determined for Israel to fill up the measure of her sin. Israel would fill up the measure of her sin by killing Jesus' apostles and prophets. But Israel killed the apostles and prophets of Jesus long after AD 34 and 35. Therefore, the filling up of the measure of Israel's sin was not fulfilled by 34, 35 AD, meaning the 70 weeks were not fulfilled by and did not end by AD 34 and 35. Listen to me. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 9 is incredibly important. And let me drive this home. I really do hope that you will get your Bible out. And by the way, I've written extensively on this in my book, Who is This Babylon? I have a very, very special study in that book on Paul, end times martyr. Because you see, if we fail to see, if we fail to see, to acknowledge and to honor Paul's critical eschatological role, yes, indeed, to bring in the coming of the Lord, we're going to miss much of the eschatological narrative. Colossians chapter 1 verse 24, pardon me, writing in approximately 62 A.D., writing, therefore, after 1 Corinthians chapter 4, which was written, you know, in 57, maybe as late as 59, Paul said, I now rejoice in my suffering for you. Listen to me carefully. Please catch the power of what Paul says. This passage, just like 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 9, has perplexed and challenged scholars, and many scholars, as I've already mentioned, say, oh, well, you know, wow. Paul's an egomaniac. How dare Paul say what he said? What did Paul say? I now rejoice in my sufferings for you, the Colossians, for the church of the first century. Watch. And fill up in my flesh what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. Wow. Now, Paul, were you telling us that Jesus didn't suffer enough? No. Clearly not. You know what Paul is talking about? There's a term found in the New Testament, found over and over and over again. It's found in Romans 8, found in 1 Peter chapter 5, found in other passages as well. I won't mention them for brevity's sake. But this little term, the sufferings of Christ, is incredibly important. Let me read a passage to you. Romans chapter 8. Now, here's what's interesting. Many, many, many commentators literally ignore this verse, and they divorce it from the next verse, as if they're unrelated. Well, you know, in my Bible, there is a division headline that says, from suffering to glory. Well, that's right. But what is this suffering? Verse 17. If you are children, Paul says, then you are heirs, heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with Him, that we might also be glorified with Him. The sufferings of Christ. I consider, Paul said, very next verse, that the sufferings of the present time, that's Paul's present time 2,000 years ago, are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. It's literally about to be revealed in us. But notice, Paul is referencing the fact that he and they were participating in the sufferings of Christ. Oh, wait a minute. Christ had died, you know, 30 years previously. How can they be participating in the sufferings of Christ? Because Christ's suffering was part of the end time suffering. And that he said that generation would fill up the measure of Israel's guilt in persecuting the saints and fill up the measure of the suffering of the saints. Now, back to Colossians chapter 1. Remember, Paul said, I now fill up in my flesh what is lacking in the afflictions of Christ. Now, in the Greek, this is all in what is known as the emphatic. In other words, Paul is saying, guess what, guys? I've been especially designated by God to fill up the measure of what is lacking in the afflictions of Christ. Many, many scholars have taken note of this, saying that Paul was saying he was playing an absolutely critical role in the eschatological narrative of filling up the measure of suffering. Now, very, very quickly, go to Revelation chapter 6, 9 and following. John said, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. Who are these? Oh, they're martyrs. And they cried out, how long, O Lord, holy and true. Do you not avenge us on those who dwell on the earth? What do they want? Vindication and vengeance. And white robes were given unto them, and they were told to rest for a little while. Now watch this. This is Revelation 6. This is after the cross. This is after 34 and 35 A.D., where the 70 weeks were supposedly ended. And yet, Daniel was told 70 weeks were determined to fill up the measure of sin. And here in Revelation chapter 6, they were given white robes and told to rest for a little while until their fellow brethren, who should be slain, pardon me, as they were, should be, what? Fulfilled. So John in Revelation was looking for the fulfillment of Daniel 9:24. Because you see, Israel would fill up the measure of her sin, finish the transgression, by persecuting the church and filling up the measure of suffering. But this was in Revelation, which is after 34-35 A.D., meaning the 70 weeks and the filling up of the measure of sin could not have ended and been fulfilled in 34-35 A.D. And I want to close on this. In 1 Peter, and this is really quite remarkable, by the way, remember that in Revelation chapter 3, 10 and following, the Lord said to the church at Philadelphia, I know your works, I know your labor, I know your faithfulness, and I will keep you from the hour of the fiery trial that is about to come. Now, pay attention, those of you who believe that Revelation was written after the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. Here is Jesus saying a fiery trial was about to come. Who's John writing to? Oh, the seven churches of Asia, right? And a fiery trial was about to come. Philadelphia would be spared, but the fiery trial was still coming. Now, in 1 Peter, Peter is writing to whom? Oh, the churches of Asia. And in 1 Peter chapter 4, Peter says this, Beloved, do not think it strange. Now, the King James, New King James, and other translations really don't do a good job on this, because I can tell you, there's no question at all about the Greek tenses here. But Peter says, Do not think it strange concerning the trial, fiery trial, which is to, as if it's future. No. This is literally, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial that is among you. Okay, wait a minute. Revelation 3:10 and following, fiery trial to come, churches of Asia. 1 Peter chapter 4, brethren, don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial that is among you. Well, why would Peter say, brethren, don't think this is strange? Well, the reason he says that is because they were supposed to know that it was coming. How would they know it was supposed to be coming? Oh, well, because John in Revelation had already told them, meaning Revelation was written before 1 Peter. And now watch this. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8 and 9, Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are being experienced by your brotherhood in the world. Now, that word experience is likewise not a happy translation. It is the Greek word epiteleo, and means that this suffering that they were enduring, that their brethren were enduring in the churches of Asia, to whom John wrote, Epitaleo means to fill up. Oh, wait a minute. Revelation 6, you have to suffer just a little while until the number of the saints should be fulfilled. But a fiery trial is coming. Peter, writing to the same people, said the fiery trial is among you, and it's filling up the measure of sin, just like Revelation 6, 9 to 11 said, that little while of suffering would fill up the measure of sin. Oh, and by the way, Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 1, they only had to suffer a little while, just like Revelation 6. Folks, there's no way out of it. I'm sorry. Proper exegesis, applying analogia scriptura, it is absolutely undeniable that Israel did not fill up the measure of her sin prior to the cross. Israel's last days were not prior to the cross. God was not through with Israel and the law of Moses at the cross. And Israel did not fill up the measure of their sin in 34 and 35 A.D. Israel filled up the measure of their sin just like Jesus predicted, just like Paul said, just like John said, by killing Jesus' apostles and prophets, none of which happened by 34 or 35 A.D. Now, since the filling up of the measure of sin would take place within no later than the 70 weeks of Daniel, chapter 9, that means that since the filling up of the measure of sin took place after 34, 35 A.D., that means the 70 weeks did not end in 34 and 35 A.D. Listen, do yourself a favor. Get a copy of my book, Seal Up Vision and Prophecy, which we'll get to in a little bit, as Daniel was told that 70 weeks were determined for the fulfilling of all, not some, not one, but all prophecy. 70 weeks are determined for the resurrection, proving the resurrection occurred no later than AD 70. Okay, out of time. Thank you so much for joining me. In our next video, we'll pick up with another one of the constituent elements of Daniel chapter 9. Believe me, it'll be worth your time. I'll see you there.